I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from iHeart Radio. Allie Wentworth has a lot of titles: actor, comedian, New York Times bestselling author, wife, mother, and podcast host. I'll add another title: one of the funniest people I know. You may recognize Allie Wentworth as Jerry's girlfriend Schmoopy on Seinfeld's classic Soup Nazi episode, or from her more than 100 appearances on The Tonight Show, or from when she was a correspondent on Oprah Winfrey's show. You may also have read one of her best-selling books, Allie in Wonderland, Happily Allie After, and the latest, Go Ask Allie, which shares a name with the podcast she launched last year.
I have gotten the biggest get in the entertainment world. It's not Beyonce. It's my daughter, Elliot Stephanopoulos. I'm talking about growing a teenager in a pandemic, and you are a teenager in a pandemic, and you're my teenager in a pandemic.
Allie and I have been friends for a while, and I've long admired her fearlessness in poking fun at herself and at others, including me.
Are you taking precautions not to have more kids, if I may be so bold? Because I feel like there's another 8 to 10 in you.
My wife and I always struggle with that, which is you have a baby and you sit there and go, aren't they great?
Yeah.
Aren't they so great? What's one more?
Yeah.
What's one
more?
We do that
with dogs. Because puppies are cute, just as cute as babies. So I get it.
Yeah.
I understand. I wish you guys could have some more for us, because one of ours is going to college in the fall.
Let me ask you about that. You got married when you were how old?
35.
And you had your first kid when you were how old?
36.
Right. So it was not the typical, you know.
No. Believe me, that was the right thing to do. I keep telling my daughters, do not rush into marriage.
Right.
Because everybody I know that got married in their 20s is divorced now. Right. I don't think you're the same person in your 20s that you are in your mid-30s.
But when you got married, and you certainly, I guess, from the get-go didn't rule out having kids, did you say to yourself, this is going to affect my work?
Not once.
You didn't think about that at all?
No.
Never?
I don't think I was ever big or famous enough to think that it would affect my work. And I was certainly not known for my body, if you know what I mean. So It never felt like that. What I did was, when I married George, we moved to DC so he could do his Sunday show this week. And so I thought, all right, how do I recalibrate everything? How do I pivot and so that I can have a career? But I live in Washington, DC, which is, you know, if you're an actor, it doesn't exist, you know? So I started writing. I started writing a book, and then Oprah hired me. So I would go to Chicago once a week, which was a fantastic job. So I tried to figure out a way to have some kind of a career. But here, at the end of the day, you know, not to use a disgusting word, but George's career, it trumped mine. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was really like we had to kind of go where he went. So
yeah. No, I mean, I understand, but I just was thinking that, you know, you are someone, and I don't say this, you know, just to be pleasant or whatever. I mean, I think you're really fucking funny. I mean, you're funny.
Oh, thank you, Alec.
And if someone came to you now and they said to you, you're going to do a four-camera sitcom in New York and you're going to shoot 18 episodes or 22 episodes, would the answer be yes? Or do you like the way things are now, which is you work a little bit, you don't have to work?
I'd say yes. They're grown. They have their own independent lives.
They have no use for you. Yeah,
no use for me. They know how to make a sandwich. I'm needier than ever. And also, I'm faced with mortality. You know, I got my shelf life is, you know, unless they're going to reboot the Golden Girls. Even those girls were like in their mid-50s.
Yeah.
So I would absolutely do that. And there are things that we would adjust. You know, when I did Nightcap, which you and your wife were on and were so hilarious, there are, you know, I created a couple shows that took a lot of energy. And in one show, Headcase, I played a very dysfunctional shrink. We were shooting in LA and I was going back and forth on the red eye and I got shingles because I was completely stressed out. And that's right. When I said, I can't work in LA.
I wonder for you, I mean, you've worked and then you raised your kids and you worked less than you might have. Because I mean, I view you as somebody who you could just be working all the time. You could be doing starring in a show, a network sitcom, 22 episodes. I mean, whatever you want to do, you'd have no problem doing it.
Yeah. Although there's a different thing, which is I just have no, like, what the fuck is how I think about everything now. Great. If you said to me right now, let's go do Love Letters at the Wharf Theater, I go, great, let's do it. Like, I have nothing to lose. And I'm excited for anything that's sort of new and different and happy to perform because I'm not so focused on myself anymore at all.
When you did Nightcap, whose idea was that? You? Was that all completely self-generated?
Yes. Yep.
And how many episodes did you do?
We did two seasons of about 30-something. And it
no.
Came, yeah, we did
how
a
many
lot.
Episodes per season?
God, we did, I want to say 16 or so. I mean, a lot. But the great thing about that show was I used to do The Tonight Show all the time. Jay Leno had me on all, like, I did it over 100 times. And I didn't necessarily have anything to promote. They would call me and say, you know, Melanie Griffith has a flu. Can you be here in 20 minutes? And I would go in and just tell funny stories. And I'm not a stand-up comedian. So I would really just have to pull stuff from my life. And while I was there, I would see the most incredible things, like, from celebrities, you know, because I was always the second guest. And, you know, just like I remember one guy came in, movie star, and his stylist came in with racks and racks of the same white shirt and the same pair of jeans. So he was going to decide right before he went out, you know, just crazy stuff. Or the publicist and the actress were not coming out of the wardrobe room because they were having sex. And the and PAs are running around going like, you know, where? And I just thought, this is the show. Who gives a shit what the actors say or promoting their movie? Whatever is happening behind here is the show.
Now, you came from a very proper family, correct?
Yes.
How would you describe it? You came from what kind of family?
Dysfunctional, but proper. Proper sounds
properly
great.
Dysfunctional. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I went to boarding school. My mother was social secretary of the Reagan White House. Only Democrat in the Reagan White House.
Oh wow.
Yeah. My stepfather was one of the editors of the London Sunday Times and chief foreign correspondent, and my father was a reporter during Watergate for the Washington Post. So I grew up in that world.
And when you went into this business, I mean, did your family have a different plan for you?
Listen, for my family, when I said I want to be an actor, they thought it was just a phase. I'd grow out of it.
Sure.
And then I said, no, I'm going to be an actor. And then my mother was basically like, well, then just go be a whore. Then just go go to a brothel and put your name on the... So they didn't get it at all.
At least Las Vegas is sunny.
Yes.
Go to the Mustang Ranch. It's warm there.
Yes. And if you can dance, even better. So... I you know, left all that. I went to L.A. I didn't know anybody. I had no connections in that world at all. And
how old were you into L.A.? Right out of college?
Right out of NYU, yep.
So 4 years at NYU?
4 years at NYU.
For what?
Acting, Circle in the Square. And somebody at William Morris came to see me in a play, and he said, you have a nice, generic, girl next door, best friend look. You should go to L.A. And I went, all right.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. And so I went to L.A. and I thought that I would eventually marry Hugh Grant or Matthew Perry or one of those guys. And
the head of the studio.
Yeah. Well, if my boobs were bigger. But then I met George and I, you know, it was like the Godfather.
Comedian Allie Wentworth. When it comes to great episodes from the Here's the Thing archives, you can always check out my episode with Mr. Allie Wentworth, George Stephanopoulos. Or for more funny women who can really write, my conversation with Paula Pell, who was a writer at Saturday Night Live for nearly 20 years.
I was always a bit of a class clown. I really pushed the envelope because I would be funny in class, and I'd do things like one of my teachers, I would go by him and drag my hand along the chalk shelf, and then I'd come over and I'd say, you know, Mr. Gersh, you're just a really great teacher, and I'd pat him on the back and I'd leave like a handprint. He'd let me make him a little bit the fool for a moment, yeah. And then he'd do, you know, he looked like Rob Reiner in All in the Family. He had the big bushy mustache and the long hair.
He played along.
He just kind of looked to camera three, you know, non-existent, and the class would crack up.
Hear more of my conversation with Paula Pell at heresthething.org. When we come back, Allie talks about being set up on a blind date with George Stephanopoulos. I'm Alec Baldwin. And you're listening to Here's the Thing. In the spring of 2001, Allie Wentworth was newly back in New York City and found herself talked into
a life-changing lunch. Where did you first see him face-to-face in person?
At Fred's, which was the restaurant at Barney's on 61st and Madison. That's where we were going to meet. And now, of course, I knew who he was. He was George Stephanopoulos.
Oh, it was a blind date?
Ish. I mean, I knew who he was, of course.
Right. But who set you up on the date?
An old friend of his that worked in the White House with him.
Why did they think that would be a good match?
We were going to swap. I offered up my older brother, who was in L.A., who worked for David Lynch, and she offered up George, thinking, you know, George was a one-date wonder. Like, he never got serious. So it was very easy for her to trade him up because she knew he wouldn't go on a second date with me.
He wasn't married before?
Never. Never lived with anybody. I'm the first person he said, I love you to.
Wow.
My virgin bride. So when we were being set up, I was not interested. And George gives me so much shit about it because he said, that's not true, that's not true. But I wasn't. He was not my type. I didn't want anybody from the political world. I like a tall, simian-looking man. And so he was just, you know, I thought this will be my, you know, my date with George Stephanopoulos. It'll be like a New Yorker article someday. You know what I mean?
Part of my routine.
Yeah, part of my routine, which it has become anyway. But I didn't shower. I didn't shave my legs. I wore a black suit because that meant smart to me. I read the New York Times, the financial section. I read the whole thing. And I thought we'll have a really interesting intellectual conversation. And that'll be that. And I got to Fred's, and there was George in an Armani suit that was way too big with the shoulder pads. And I went, all right, don't be shallow. Look beyond it. Look beyond it.
Okay.
And we sat down. The first thing we talked about was antidepressants. What are you on? What are you on? And I thought, okay, this is good.
This is the glue.
This is the glue. And we both ordered crab salad. And afterwards, he walked me out and he shook my hand. Now, in LA, where I was living, if you went out with somebody and they shook your hand, they weren't interested. If they didn't drag you yeah. by the hair like a caveman into their gross bachelor pad in West Hollywood, then they weren't yeah. interested. So, and George went, it's very nice to meet you. And I went, oh, Jesus. Okay, very nice to meet you. And then that night he called me and said, do you want to come out again? And I didn't play the game. I don't know how to play games. So I said to him, yep, I'm free tonight. I'm free tomorrow night. Listen, I'm supposed to go away for the weekend with my mom and sisters, but I'll blow that off.
You liked him.
I did like him.
What about him did you like?
I was attracted to him, which I did not think I would be. I found him, and still do, very sexy. And right. I found his brain very sexy, and he has a
of course.
Cute smile. And I've written about it, and I've said it's like a good melon, but it felt like, oh, you're my people.
My wife, same thing. Like the way she looked, her hair color, her yeah. voice, all of it. I was like, oh God, she's my dream girl. You know,
I felt that way when I met her too, by the way.
But you and my wife had a very intimate moment on the show. It was really.
Well, and I wrote that for a reason. I wrote to have right. your wife's vagina on my face right. for about 6 seconds.
Yeah.
And
you got a lot, as they say in Bye Bye Birdie, you got a lot of living yeah. to do.
Or as I like to say, I got yeah. a whiff and I get it. So,
oh, God.
So anyway, yes, all that stuff, all that chemical stuff happened.
Chemistry.
Yes. And that weekend I was going to a spa with my mother and my sisters, and I spent the whole time on the phone with George. They were all yoga-ing and eating bran muffins, and I was at Canyon Ranch with my head out the window, chain smoking and talking to George the whole time. Every once in a while they come back and they, you know, throw some almond butter at me. And then we were engaged 2 months later, and that felt like it took a long time. It did.
Took me 2 whole fucking months yeah. to close this deal.
I was
deal.
Like, hello, hello. And then we went to Greece, and I knew that he had a ring.
How did you know?
His nephew dealt in jewelry. I don't know what that means, but it sounds shady. But he dealt in jewelry. And George had to go have breakfast with him the day we were leaving for Greece. And I thought, there's only one reason. He would meet his nephew who deals in jewelry. And it was in his knapsack. So the whole way to Greece, I kept hiding his knapsack in the lounge and on the plane. Just because I'd like to see him sweat.
Don't mess with him.
Really fuck him up. And then we were in Mykonos and he proposed to me. And I have to tell you, not ever being a celebrity myself, I had no idea until he proposed to me in Mykonos and somehow the press found out about it. And we had photographers all over the rocks across the water from our hotel. And we would walk down the street and there'd be 30 paparazzi all over us. And George's hand would be sweating and he'd say like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, Allie, I'm so sorry. I was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. George, could you step back for a moment? You're in my light, George.
Who wants singles, guys? Who wants singles? I mean, you know, I almost took my shirt off. It was all very exciting that first time, you know, that kind of Tom and Nicole moment. And
sure.
then it was horrible. Yeah. But it was fun for that day.
Now, that magical moment on Mykonos when he finally found the knapsack that you hid under the rocks and said, oh, some guy came in. I think that guy on the bicycle there just stole the knapsack,
catch him,
George.
Catch him.
Run, George, run. When you did all that, at the moment that he presents you with the ring, were you both on antidepressants at that moment? Or did you abstain?
I was. He was off by then. I think the White House really took it out of him. But then I was still on. Definitely still on. And in fact, the funny thing, you should bring that up, because we went on our honeymoon and I decided to self-regulate and self-medicate. And I decided I didn't need antidepressants anymore. I didn't realize that you taper off, you know, so I just went cold turkey. And that was bad because I was naked in the fetal position in our bathroom. It was it was apocalypse now.
Covered in bird poop. They found you in the pond with all the cranes, covered in crane
poop.
With
the flamingo leg in my mouth, and I don't know how it happened.
Yeah,
so I had to get Zoloft FedExed to the Caribbean.
Well, it's funny because in my lifetime, if I've ever taken things which were like sleep aids, I've got horrible insomnia and I have all my adult life. I'm 35 years sober. I've been in AA 30. This year was 36
Congratulations.
Years. Well, thank you. And I always tell people that I haven't slept since the day I got sober.
Yeah.
Once I stopped drinking, I couldn't sleep. So I have really, really like, so at times I have like crippling insomnia. Like I sleep like maybe 3 hours a night. You know what I mean? And the problem with it is if I took any kind of drugs and it didn't help, I woke up tired and groggy.
Yeah.
So I got very, very nervous about any kind of medication because God knows if I found one that worked, I wouldn't even be talking to you right now. I'd be asleep.
You'd be Sonny
right
Von Bulow. Yeah. Well, I took Ambien once. I was in LA and I come from New York and time difference, blah, blah, blah. Took Ambien, went to the Malibu Mart, that shopping center in Malibu, and bought six jeans of the exact same jean in the exact same size. And I don't remember doing it. I also got an email the next day from Pottery Barn Kids asking me what address did I want the Princess Canopy bed delivered. Don't remember.
Well, one thing I would do when I was in the kind of Lovecraftian baffles of my insomnia, I'd sit there and I'd start to buy things online, like antique alarm clocks.
Yeah.
I'd be like, you know, I'm like, where's this guy? In Germany? They probably have better alarm clocks in Germany than here. How much does he want for the alarm clock? $1,800? And I could probably get the same thing at a flea market in Syracuse for like $30. I don't care. I want it.
Do you meditate?
I do now. Yeah, I do a lot of deep breathing. I do what's called clavicle breathing, where you try to literally fill your lungs up to where you almost can feel your lungs at the bottom of your chin if you breathe deep enough. And I do this very deep breathing meditation thing to sleep. And it does work. But one time, I take an Ambien. Like I work, and it gets to be 11 o'clock at night or 12 o'clock at night. And I'm like, okay, sleep. 1, 2, 3, sleep.
Oh, God.
Simon says, sleep. And I can't sleep. So I take the Ambien, nothing happens. I take another one, nothing happens.
Oh, God.
I take the third one. I think I took the third and the fourth one. Then all of a sudden, I'm like, I'm literally laying in bed and I'm watching, you know, Jimmy Fallon. And my daughter Ireland calls. And I think, like, while I'm on the phone call, she's in California. She was like 14.
Yeah.
And I go, so I think maybe tomorrow I'm going to get a ticket. I'm like,
Jesus.
I go out. And Ireland's going, Dad? Dad?
No,
this is a true story. And I go, I'm okay. I took these pills. and I'm trying to go to sleep now. I'm like, how? In 2001, they're disconnecting. Cure delays disconnecting my circuits.
Oh my God.
And the next thing you know, I hear, bang, 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 bang.
Uh-oh.
On the service elevator door of my apartment, it's three firemen with axes.
Oh, my God.
And an EMT medic, and they're like, we got a phone call, Mr. Baldwin, we're really sorry. We got a call from your daughter. You have to put your clothes on and come with us, sir, right now, to the hospital. And I'm like,
I don't know what you're talking about. Are you a fireman or is this is this trick or treat? You want some candy? You're like, I'm so out
and
of
naked.
They make me get dressed. No, I'm in a bathrobe. They take me to the hospital. And I go, okay. I start to sober up very quickly. And I go, I took one too many Ambien because they weren't working. They were like, uh-huh. Sure, Mr. Bowman, sure. And I never took another one of those fucking things again.
I mean,
my daughter called the police because she thought I was ODing.
But good for Ireland to know how to do that. I think Ambien's dangerous.
You do?
Yes. Yes. People have all these crazy Ambien stories. I took them away from George because he was taking them for a while. He only sleeps like 4 or 5 hours anyway.
Because of his schedule?
Yeah. We go to bed at 8 and 8:30 and I go with him.
That's love. That's love. Now, you go to sleep or you just lay next to him and you're like on YouTube?
No phones allowed in the bed and no TV.
You're in bed and you're trying to get to sleep at 8, 8:30 and he's up what time?
2, 2:30.
No.
Yeah. He gets up, he reads every newspaper. And here's the thing. We just started a production company. So he's up at 2:30, not only reading all the papers, he's reading scripts, he's reading articles. He's doing all of it. Which he loves. He loves this kind of new thing. He's got this deal with Hulu and it's all very exciting. So he can't sleep because of that. You know, he wants to get up and, you know, read stuff. Starring vehicles for Alec Baldwin. So he sleeps, I don't know, 5 hours maybe. We just were on vacation and, you know, he slept in because he slept till 4. So I never am awake when he wakes up in the morning. So I have to go to bed with him at night or we're not, how's the marriage?
Now, what did your family think when you married George?
They couldn't believe it.
They love him?
My mother hysterically cried. I think she wanted to marry him, but it was okay if I did. You know, she was beyond excited. I was bringing home comedy writers. And then I brought home a French director. And my mother goes, you have an affair with him. You don't marry him. So they were beyond thrilled when I married George. I mean, still, they all love him the most. What does George want? What does George say? What would George want for dinner? There's a lot of that.
Beyond the war room, Bergala and Clinton and Carville and your husband, beyond all of them, in the promotional lap that you take, I am always happy to do Good Morning America. And I will say, can I do it with George? Can I do my segment with George? Because I'm so admiring of him. And he did my podcast.
I will say one thing to this, which is what I love about George is he's genuinely curious. It could be anybody. It could be Chuck Schumer. It could be Zac Efron. If it's not an area that he knows about, he's interested to know about. Truly. You know, he doesn't just go, oh, it's an actor. Who fucking cares? He's like, all right, well, I'm interested. What is this person? What can I glean from this? Which I think is a very interesting trait and a great trait.
Comedian and author Allie Wentworth. If you're enjoying this conversation, tell a friend and be sure to follow Here's the Thing on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. After the break, Allie talks about parenting in a pandemic, her social media rules for her teenage daughters, and how she learned to be funny. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Allie Wentworth is one of those people everyone, friends and strangers alike, ask for advice. Last year, when she got COVID, she had the inspiration for her own podcast, Go Ask Allie.
We were, you know, everything takes forever in this business. So we were talking. I was talking to Shonda Land about it. And then in the middle of COVID, I called them and I said, you know what? I had COVID. I'm lying here in bed. I have two teenage daughters downstairs. I said, I'm ready to do a podcast and it's going to be how do you grow a teenager in a pandemic? And they're like, great.
What's been the challenges for you about that?
There have been good and bad. You know, the girls have anxiety like me and George. So they worry. They worry about school and they worry what's going to happen and they're worried about college. Our eldest, Elliot, is going to Brown in the fall, but there's no prom. There's a lot of that. Now, on the one hand, there's no FOMO, so you're not missing anything. But it's not natural for two teenage girls to be home with their parents for a year and not see anybody.
No.
On the flip side, in terms of our family, it was fantastic. To have George have that kind of time with his kids, we would have 3-hour dinners where we had amazing discussions. We, as a family, we really kind of grew and it was fantastic, but it's not good for them. I kept saying, like, you know, I don't want them to go drop Molly or give hand jobs, but they should be out kissing boys and, you know, what, having normal teenage experiences.
They should be living. They should be living.
Yeah.
And making mistakes, learning from those mistakes.
All of it. And then there's the social media part of it, which is, you know, they got sucked into that little social media void, which was their only contact, their only connection, which, you know, I have such specific and strong views about social media also. I don't want my girls to sort of sexualize themselves because there's such a dangled carrot about, like, get likes, be sexy. And I'm like, I don't ever want to see bikini shots. I don't, you know, to me, that's a hole you're trying to fill. Like, you be substantial.
You have two girls.
Two girls, yeah. And I said, the stuff also that you're going to put on social media, colleges, everybody looks at that stuff and that stuff can come back to haunt you. So,
yeah, I've made my mistakes on social media because what I realized was I thought to myself, oh, this is my chance to bypass the mainstream media and talk directly to my fans. Then after about a year and a half, I thought, maybe I would like to have a little membrane between me and my fans.
Yes.
Lorne Michaels had a great line. He said, YouTube, the logo is broadcast yourself, he said. And one thing we've learned is maybe it's nice to have a layer of producers and executives between you and the camera.
Yeah.
And you broadcasting yourself.
Yeah.
And to a large degree, he's right. Elliot is going to Brown. And the other one is how old?
She's 15. She's a sophomore. And let me tell you something. She's an amazing babysitter. Like, she is a baby. I'm not kidding. She's a baby whisperer. She'll take all 74 of your kids at one time.
What do you think it is that, for me, when I was young, I would watch TV? You had to watch TV and had to really watch it. There was no pause, no rewind, no VCR, no nothing. Zippo. Network TV, broadcast TV. So you watched and you become funny by absorbing what's funny from other people. And I'd watch anything. I'd watch Bob Hope and you name it. How was that in your life? Like, what was media like in your childhood?
Well, we were only allowed to watch 1 hour of television a week. That was the rule. But I had divorced parents. So when I went to see my dad on the weekend, his second wife hated the fact that he had kids from a former marriage. So she would put me in front of the TV with one of those heat up TV trays. And I would watch Bob Newhart, Carol Burnett. I would watch that whole Friday lineup. And that's exactly where I learned, oh, that's funny. If you wear the curtain rod on your show, that's funny. That's funny. And it's instinctual too. Because I remember once I had a meeting with Jodie Foster and she said to me, did you take classes for comedy? I said, I never took classes. I was part of the Groundlings when I moved to LA. And she goes, that's because it's instinctual. You cannot teach it. And she's right. It is instinctual. And that watching Carol Burnett was an instinctual kind of osmosis for me.
What I think is interesting about you is that I've worked with people who, they're actors by and large, and the concentration is comedy, they're comic actors, who they themselves are not that funny.
Right.
Off the set, they don't think of funny things, they don't say funny things.
Isn't that interesting?
And you yourself are funny. You're funny. Whether you're, whatever the writing is, whatever the situation is, and you're saying that that came from just osmosis.
And then you learn over the years, you learn, oh, this makes people laugh. When I was a teenager, I was fat because I went to Spain and I ate as much as I could. And my mother walked by me in the airport, looked at me right in the eye and kept walking, didn't know it was me.
You went to Spain when you were a teenager?
Yeah, I went for 4 months. I love Spain and I loved the country, the people, the language. And I went to live with a family who were obese and they ate like 6 meals a day, like potatoes and oil, sangria. And they fed me like a foie gras goose. They just shoved food in my mouth. I gained 40 pounds and couldn't be happier. I even broke a chicken's neck, you know, the whole thing. So I came back and I was fat. And listen, when you're fat in high school, you go, all right, so no one wants to hook up with me. So I'm going to find a different route. So I was funny.
And what ages you were overweight between what years of your life?
Sophomore year in high school till sophomore year in college.
So not that long, five,
of
6 years.
Of the most formidable years.
No, critical years, yeah.
But I still got the guy. But that's all about, again, like honing that comedy thing. And you have an audience of people at a party or hanging out, and that's where you learn it. You know, you've learned very quickly what gets a laugh, what doesn't. And same with stories. The reason I would go do The Tonight Show all the time is because I had already rehearsed those stories at a dinner party. And so I knew they worked. So if I got a call, you know, even today when I go do a talk show, I go, oh, you know, it was really funny was that thing that George and I just did. And I remember telling my kids that and they were laughing really hard. I'm going to tell that story. So that's what you do.
It's like the little metal box your mother had in the kitchen with recipes, yes, where the index cards went. And in yours, this is your brain. You have a file with all those stories you tell.
Yeah.
How did you lose weight?
It fell off naturally. It wasn't supposed to be. It fell off naturally.
So you reversed the course.
I reversed the course. But, you know, I have only had one scene where I was scantily clothed. I never had a career where I worried about that feeling of, oh, I'm going to do this film. I got to get in shape. I got to work out. Never.
Now, you have a cadre of show business chicks that are your great buddies.
I do. I have a little posse.
You guys have your own little club.
Yeah.
You have a posse.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, Mariska, Brooke Shields.
Deb Messing.
Yeah, when she's in town. I mean, Mariska and I, during the pandemic, we kind of quarantined together, like our families. So I saw her a lot during the pandemic, too much. And so, you know, some of the other girls I haven't really seen as much. Brooke I have. But, you know, now that things are opening up and people are getting vaccinated, we can be a full-on girl power group.
What do you watch? Name two or three things you watch, drama or comedy, that you really, really thought were special. Because I respect your opinion a lot.
I watched Lupin on Netflix.
Okay. You say it like, oh, like everyone knows. Lupin?
I'm sorry. I thought, well.
I'm sorry. I didn't go to boarding school. What is Lupin?
No, these people in my literary soiree and I watch Lupin. And Lupin is fantastic. It's this incredibly dynamic, handsome black guy who's a thief and whose father was set up to seem like he was like a butler, that he stole a diamond necklace from a Madoff type guy and went to jail and killed himself in jail. And the son becomes this international thief and seeks revenge by stealing this necklace at Sotheby's. Anyway, it's a cat and mouse, great show. I watched Promising Young Woman. I thought that was a great movie, streaming movie. Oh, Call My Agent. You would love it, Alec. It's just like Nightcap. It's about a dysfunctional agents in Paris. They're always pandering to their clients.
In French, with subtitles.
With subtitles, yes. Tell me what you've been watching, besides Nickelodeon.
Right, besides a lot of Powerpuff Girls. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I sent an email to Owen Wilson, and I said, Owen, I said, my God, these Cars movies. I said, you are such a part of my kid's childhood. You're such a part of my life. We've watched these fucking movies. We've watched each of the three movies 100 times each.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how fabulous you are in this. You're so great. These movies mean so, they have every Cars, every Lightning McQueen, bed sheet, bath towel, slippers, every fucking thing. And he writes me back. He's like, oh, Alec, great, great. Yeah, the Lightning McQueen was so good for me, too. But yeah, Disney Plus, it's like the eternal flame at Arlington. It's on in my house 24 hours a day, Disney Plus. But for me, because the Hamptons International Film Festival is coming, I watch a lot of docs. I watch a lot of docs, a lot. And there's one that came on that was really fun, if you can, because we look for like a mix of something serious and topical or biographical. You know, when Susan Lacy did the bio of Jane Fonda, I loved that movie.
Loved. Yep.
And really well done. But there's one called Lily Topples the World. And it's about a woman who's the Domino's champion. She's the Chaluli of Domino's. She does arrangements that all radiate out into patterns that are like
amazing.
A Georgia O'Keeffe painting results from her tapping
amazing.
One thing. You can't believe this young woman, what she does. Let me tell you something. You're still one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life. I got a part for you.
All right. What do I got to do? I hope there's nudity.
There is no nudity.
All right. All right.
Thank you for doing this with us.
Alec, thank you.
My love to you.
My love to you.
Actor, comedian, and author, Allie Wentworth. I'm Alec Baldwin, and this is Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio. We're produced by Kathleen Russo, Kerry Donahue, and Zach McNeese. Our engineer is Frank Imperial. Thanks for listening.